Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show. Connor, how do people call into the show?
844-967-2789.
So before the break, we were talking to CJ, and this was this morning's theme is sort of complexity and how simplifying complexity has maybe caused us to get off course in so many different ways. He was particularly interested in simplifying, I guess, the issue of our Chinese relationship. He made the accusation, I think, that he thought Nancy Pelosi was great because he thought she had larger, I don't know what the technical term should be, gonads, than the president did with respect to her handling of the situation with China. Apparently,
I can't decide if your summary was better than the original presentation.
I'm not sure which word is worse. Which word is better for or more civilized?
Yeah, we revisited it already. It's done.
Yeah, we passed it. But and before we get to talking about, I guess, some of the complexities in the China policy that might give us all pause in terms of how quickly we reach a conclusion about what the United States ought to be doing today. I just saw the news flash that the Labor Department announced that there were 528,000 new jobs created in the month of July, which is an interesting expose on the complexity of the economics, because right up until the moment that they opened their mouth and said 528,000 jobs, the economists of this country and the financial community were speculating that that number would be about 250,000 jobs, and that the economy had slowed down in terms of the job creation, when 528,000 is a very robust number. And so then we have to scratch our heads and say, okay, we're being told that we're on the verge of a recession. In fact, that the classical definition of a recession for many people was two quarters in a row with a declining GDP, and lo and behold, that's what we've had for the last two quarters. So there are some who would announce that we are in recession. There were others who said, hold on, you know, we still feel robust growth ongoing. We have inflation of 9%+. There are those who believe that that level of inflation would cause a slowdown in our economy based on a worry about the future impact that it would have. We have the Federal Reserve Bank increasing interest rates at about as rapid a clip as they can, trying to put the brakes on inflation. Everyone has the view that that increase in interest rates will cause a recession and will cause a slowdown, for instance, in job creation. And what do we have? 528,000 new jobs, which is a revelation, I think, that the complexity of our economy currently has experts scratching their head trying to understand what's going on. One other complexity we have is shortage. And one of the shortages we have that no one is able to explain very well right now is a shortage of employees in all sectors of the economy. Teachers, right?
Huge teacher shortage. That there's been, again, the state that has been getting a lot of coverage is Texas, because I think they must have, I don't know if there was research down there that uncovered, like, you know, new and larger holes in
but the number there was
qualified
like
class.
10,000 teachers.
Yeah, we're talking about tens of thousands.
Of shortage.
A shortage. And so that, and it's leading states. In other states, the shortage is being underrepresented because they're lowering the qualifications required of people to enter classrooms.
So that's teacher shortage. But all you need to do is have a problem with your air conditioner and call up an air conditioning contractor, and they'll tell you that, gee, we'd like to get there, but we're really short on employees. We're short on staff. We're overrun with demand. We'll try and get there, you know, next week, Wednesday.
Restaurants are closing on like Mondays or Tuesdays every week because they're short employees.
Short employees. There isn't a sector of the economy that can't report that they're short employees, and yet we have this concept of recession, and we also have robust job gains. So, you know, unlike stagflation, which is a situation in which you have recession coupled with inflation, we're currently having inflation with robust growth in jobs, at least. And we have another anomaly happening, which is the interest rates are going up in the short term because of what the Federal Reserve is doing, and everyone believes that that will cause mortgage interest to go up. Mortgage interest rates did go up until last week, and mortgage interest rates start falling again. Apparently, the world believes that this inflation is a short-lived phenomena. At least the finance community does, and much of the world does. The rate of growth in home prices is slowing down. The demand for new mortgages is slowing down materially, which is slowing down the rate of increase in mortgage rates. So we've just got a complicated situation going. And the things we'd like to conclude about it, that would be simplified conclusions like, we're in a recession? Yeah, probably not. We're probably not in a recession. We have an inverted yield curve. What does that mean? Well, in the complex world of economics, that means that the treasury bills that have a 10-year maturity have a lower interest rate than the 2-year maturity treasury bonds have. So what does that mean? Well, that means that the public, instead of rewarding people who are willing to undertake the risk of a 10-year loan with a higher interest rate, they're being rewarded with a lower interest rate, which means that the finance community believes that interest rates in the long run are going to be lower than the interest rates are right now, which normally is the bellwether for recession. And yet, the jobs numbers don't look like recession. So what do we got here? What's going to happen in our economy? And how are we going to solve these shortages? What's going to solve the teacher shortage, Scott?
that's going to be, you know, that the answer to that question is far more complicated than there's no short-term fix. And you know, the short-term solution is going to be what they're already doing, which is, unfortunately, bringing in I read one article saying that current college students are being recruited to actually take leads in classrooms where there are huge shortages, mm-hmm. rather than be, you know, tutored by the teacher in the class. You know, normally when I student taught in graduate school, you know, you're working under the direct guidance of an experienced teacher. And so you're actually learning the craft and the skills that are required for you to stay organized.
Now, instead of flying co-pilot,
now it's get on in there and fly this thing.
Fly the plane.
Best of luck to you.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I'm sure you'll figure out the landing.
And, you know, you said it's complex because there's a lead time, right? You got to train teachers, and you can't just do that overnight. Yes. Well, the same is true for heating, ventilating, air conditioning engineers, right? You got to have technicians able to do that work. Nurse shortage, you got to train nurses. So there's a lead time to solve these shortages all across the economy, and we have an inflation that is basically shortage driven. We have the Federal Reserve trying to solve the inflation by increasing interest rates, which is designed to take money away from the people who would otherwise buy these products in short demand. We have a complex situation, and people talk about how rapidly we might solve inflation, and I think that the answer is that the complexities involved with a shortage are going to make it very hard to solve inflation in the near term, and it might be that the view of the financial community with this inverted yield curve is that, well, you know what, when the shortage gets solved, inflation's going to be solved and interest rates are going to come right back down again, because we'll have when shortage gets solved, we'll have an abundance of products that will cause essentially a deflationary kind of effect. So, you know, the economy is a complex issue. And I know that if CJ were on the line, he'd want to say, well, who's our president today? And, you know, this situation would be far different than it is. But the fact is that no one can lay at the feet of the president today the situation in the shortage of all of these.
That impulse to lay the current economy at the feet of the sitting president is always goofy. I mean, you know, aren't we actually looking at the collective efforts of the Trump administration in the entire term, but until there are significant changes made, you can't make that comparison.
The Trump administration stepped into an economy that had lots of momentum behind it that they inherited from the Obama period. They did pour some gasoline on the hot economy by having a tax reduction, which probably did fire up the economy even hotter, which of course creates creates the risk that we now face of a bubble type economy with potential inflation. So yeah, the Trump administration provided a bunch of problems, and then so did Mother Nature. You know, the pandemic was a significant influence in the shortages. The tariff policy that was adopted by Trump was a significant impact on the supply chain and the shortages created by the snafus in the supply chain. And so, you know, now we have this complex situation. The economy is complicated, and to try and simplify it in the way that simplified news media might carry it is to not do it justice in terms of
pin the tail on the donkey, right? I mean, you take like some specific number, whether it be positive or negative, and then you attempt to blame, you know, attach it to a political party or a specific politician, and it's just goofy.
Well, it is goofy, and it's also goofy from the standpoint of helping the public understand what they might face going forward. How should the public behave? What should they do with their money? How should they invest it? You know, the economy is complicated, and it might well be beyond the ability of people to develop an easy degree of confidence
or interest,
but they should be interested.
I agree.
It has a big impact on them.
Yes.
And so complexity for the economy ought to cause people to resist the notion that they ought to lay at the feet of politicians either the blame or the benefit of the doubt with respect to whether it was caused.
Well, certainly, if you can identify the economic problems that are challenging your life individually and specifically, you know, then you could probably then try to ascertain for yourself what a good solution would be. And then that would allow you to then go out and listen to politicians talk and know what you need to hear them say. And then also, you know, be activist and make sure that those things are being discussed and important to politicians.
Yes, and that policies that are important might be implemented. And, you know, one of the problems...
But we have to expect that from them.
Well, one of the problems I've identified that is sort of related to the economics is the problem of Tom, Dick, and Mary and the inflationary economy and the extent to which they all live paycheck to paycheck. One of the reasons they all live paycheck to paycheck in America is because they all have to pay for health insurance and child daycare out of their own income, which means that the income that they earn when in these double income earning households, the $75,000 that is the median income, is insufficient to allow them to absorb even the smallest increase in cost without having to sacrifice either health care or child daycare.
Can't go without that. My question is it always Tom, Dick, and Mary?
Yeah, well, we're going to break now. We'll be back. Sounds like Connor's beatbox. I believe it is. This is Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, Friday morning. Connor, how do callers call in?
844-967-2789. You can call in to Walk Radio.
I'm here today with my Scott Williams, namesake. Scott, how are you this morning?
I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah. So this was your first day, I think, of having an extensive conversation with CJ. CJ called in and revealed to us that he was surely capable of being bipartisan because he's consumed media in a very bipartisan way to try and gather as broadly the data as he could. I think he said one of the pieces of evidence he had for that was that he had listened to Fox News for 25 years. Isn't that right?
Yeah, the most unbiased station in the world.
Yeah, that's what he said. It was the most unbiased. So what do you think of that, Scott? I mean,
if you watch anything for 25 years, I feel like the brainwashing is now complete.
It's the job is done, right?
Yes, you're so far down the creek that you're actually about to enter the ocean. You should get a bigger boat.
Yeah, so, well, anyway, I do appreciate CJ calling in because I think it's important that people who have diverse views present them. My only hope is that the people who do that do it with enough open mind so that they're willing to talk about their positions and to try and reanalyze themselves to figure out what biases we have. I think as a teacher, one of the things you do try and understand and teach in various courses is the notion of bias, right? That people
Yes.
carry a bias?
Yes. And we all have bias. Everyone has bias. So, I mean, you know, my thing, if CJ was, if that, not CJ as a person, but if that type of a mindset, someone who has strong beliefs and opinions, was in my classroom, you know, again, this goes back to like the questioning of why with issues. And so, you know, I guess, but the one thing that I constantly remind students of in an academic setting is, you know, argument, like when you argue with someone, it's usually emotional. And then that when you argue with a sibling or you argue with a spouse, you know, you're easily pulled into emotional directions in that. But in an academic setting or in an intellectual conversation, in a debate that is ongoing in the media, you know, I think the piece that is constantly missing now is the need to understand the opposite view and the motivations for that view, and so that you truly understand why they believe what they believe. And I feel like when we, you know, and again, CJ, I'm as guilty of it as anyone. You know, we raise our voice, we talk over people, we use volume, and we revert back to the arguable point rather than understanding that we're in a situation where we're actually listening to each other, we're trying to understand each other. We're attempting eventually to find common ground so that we can agree to disagree in a way that allows the conversation to move forward, rather than just being like, you know, as Sandy has said multiple times, they just kind of stuck spinning wheels.
Well, in fact, talking about something you do know a lot about, which is education, one of the areas that we seem to be have arguments about and that are at the emotional level rather than the factual level is this question of what's wrong with public education and what should be done about it. And what is your view of that? What do you think the causative things are? Why, for instance, the MPS system clearly has some bad results coming out of it. But the question of why is such an important issue to address first, and then the question of how to solve the issues that are identified with the why become much more pertinent. And my sense is that this why is very open to discussion.
The thing that people like are we referencing like the CRT the emphasis, or are you talking about just more broadly public schools versus private schools,
yes,
versus voucher schools, how we educate?
Yes, I mean the last administration had a secretary of education who was right. Hell-bent on spreading voucher schools because it was the view that having essentially a privatized school system would solve so many of the problems associated with the outcomes of urban public schools, because most people when they talk about the
problems, Supreme Court agrees with that too, like the money now that goes to public schools are also going to go to Catholic schools. I can't remember what's the name of the case was. You probably do
in the state of Wisconsin voucher case or the federal case.
The federal case.
I don't remember the name, but the fact is that, well, and that's a slightly different issue, but it's certainly part of the same issue that it's going to have that effect. But it's, I think what relates to it is this question of what are the issues that relate to the outcomes that are always pointed at as the fundamental problem.
Well, right now the CRT debate does get to what you're referencing, because what you're referencing is the notion that, I mean, you could have it in a conversation of inside of curriculums you've removed things like welding and automobile work, you know, like shop type classes, and replace them with, you know, soft classes, and that would include what I teach, like social studies. But I think the criticism that's overwhelming the education system right now is the idea of like the whole child, where we're going to, you know, we have to foster both their intellectual and educational advancement, also with their well-being and their notion of well-being.
Well, I mean, but now you're talking is strictly about the educational process. My sense is that the debate that we fail to have is the extent to which poverty and the situation that people that children are living in their homes has a great deal to do with whatever the outcome from their schools could possibly be. So that the question of whether, you know, when you take
But isn't that a horse and cart argument? Is
Well, when you take the entire population of an area and you decide that they all have to be educated, I mean, one of the issues with voucher schools and private schools is that most of them are not randomly selected students, so that you end up with a different mix in the school than you have in the community. The issue that like Milwaukee Public Schools has is that they have all of the students in the community who might be left needing instruction after students have self-selected themselves into other schools. So you end up with a socioeconomic audience for the schools that might be a difficult problem unto itself, even beyond what curriculum you have in the school. Isn't that right?
Yes.
And so do you think that's, I mean, my sense is that just doesn't get discussed enough. And the notion of creating vouchers to solve the school problem isn't going to solve the poverty problem.
Well, I was just going to say you can't talk about one and not the other, but they're also not necessary. I mean, some people like to separate them entirely, and it makes it easier, right? It simplifies to let's talk about just the school and look at what just the school is doing versus let's look at the neighborhood, let's understand the social problems that are occurring there and their causes, and then figure out policies to try to fix that.
Well, and then
from there operate of trying to fix the school.
Well, of course, policies need to be based on facts, and facts usually are based on things like outcomes. Outcomes, however, are dependent on something more than just the curriculum in the school. So that's where I think we have a problem, is evaluating the outcomes and trying to figure out the causes and figure out what response there should be to the causes. I think we've got another break coming up. We'll be back after the break. It's a birthday. Williams, my namesake, with me. Connor, how do people call in?
People can call if they call 844-967-2789.
Well, and they should use a telephone if they're going to do that, right? That would be the best way.
Or you can just call out into the air.
Yeah.
If you take ayahuasca, you can reach out through the spiritual dimension.
Yeah, that's right.
If you see Aaron Rodgers on your way, say hi for me.
So, we have a caller, do we?
We got a couple callers. We got David from San Francisco on line one, and we got Martin on line two. So
okay, well let's go for distance first. We'll go to David in San Francisco.
Okie doke.
David,
hey,
hi, how are you?
Good morning to you. Yeah, morning. And I didn't catch who your co-host was, but morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, do I hear right? Trump is coming to town?
Yeah, Trump, well, he's coming to Waukesha, not San Francisco, but yeah, he's coming to Waukesha. Apparently, the most interesting part about that news blurb was that no other state or federal official was going to be in appearance there. So apparently, Republicans are beginning to worry about whether proximity to Donald Trump is a good idea or not.
You know, right. Well, and it gives you an opportunity, since Trump committed so many crimes, civil and criminal, there have got to be hundreds of thousands of lawsuits waiting for him. And, you know, a process server is somebody that'll deliver a summons, right?
Yeah.
And the Secret Service is, you know, if someone is a registered notary in your town and also a process server, Secret Service, there should be a way that a person can get past the Secret Service and hand him some summonses. And somebody must have a fat bundle of them, and Wisconsin alone must have a fat bundle of them. So I'm just wondering, first of all, is there an opportunity to get that done? And otherwise, Trump is basically pretending that he's above the law by being protected by Secret Service, who may have been involved with January 6th. So this would be the furtherance of a crime.
I think Donald Trump has probably had a lifelong experience of avoiding service of summons.
Right?
I suspect he's particularly good at spotting someone who might be someone who's got a summons in his hand or in his pocket, and making sure that he does not either reach out his hand and shake hands or say, yes, I am Donald Trump. Trump in response to the question. So,
well, the famous thing, drop it at their feet.
I suppose.
I've served a few.
Oh, you're a process server.
I'm not an official, but funny thing, I did one in a police board meeting. This famous evil cop out here in San Francisco was getting an award. So he's getting ready to walk up to get his award, hit him in the service with it right in the middle of a public meeting. And so he could not avoid it. Yeah, it was great. But the other thing I was going to raise,
about, have you ever thought this could be a TV show? Series, you know, don't you think you should write the screenplay for a weekly show about a very dramatic process serving?
That's right. It's nice to meet you, and here you go.
Yeah, that's right. Just there you go.
Yeah,
stick it to him.
Yeah, I mean, they were trying to get William Randolph Hearst for years.
There you go.
I was
being facetious, Steve. Huh?
Sure. What I was going to lead to was, you know, I come originally from St. Louis, really bigoted city. They played all the religions against each other, the races against each other, the nationhood, the languages against each other, and it was that the bigots could hog the tax dollars. You know, whichever bigot was in charge was able to deny taxes to, you know, use of road taxes or use of sewer board taxes to certain neighborhoods just because of bigotry. And this has been going on for centuries, but we, the people, have got to figure out a way where, you know, the taxes are actually evenly distributed as opposed to being run by a pack of bigots. And, you know, something like this abortion ruling, that's totally unprovable. Their BS about it being murder, whether or not it's alive, whether there's, you know, whole layers of abortion that are unprovable. Right. And if they're going to have tax dollars spent on unprovable budgets, the bigots are able to take tax dollars and have them spent.
I would just say one thing I would hope. It's not even that I disagree with. There's a lot of points that are floating right now, but you know, by only calling them the bigots, I feel like if we can be more specific, I understand where now we're referencing. I feel like St. Louis in the past.
Joe McCarthy's a good example.
Yeah.
Whether he'd be called a bigot or whether he was just a liar,
he actually
got millions of dollars, billions of dollars. To this day, Joe McCarthy's ghost is still causing tax dollars to be spent on wild goose chases.
Well, I think this is interesting. I started out this show talking about complexity and simplifying it, and I do think you're talking about both complicated subjects, and I think you are simplifying them. I think it would probably take a long time to have the conversation you've initiated about all the complexities, but thanks for calling in today.
Sure, we just saw it in action in St. Louis.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
And Connor, we have another caller. Connor?
Yep, he's on.
Oh, who have we had? Who is this?
Martin.
Hey, good morning.
Morning, Martin.
This is Marty. Thank you. Marty from Milwaukee.
Yeah, Martin, how are you? What do you have to say?
Marty, I think he said.
Yeah, that was a very interesting call. I'm getting a lot of feedback here.
Yeah, I think, are you talking on your speakerphone?
Yeah, I'm. My bad.
Okay.
Good morning, Sandy. That was a very interesting call. It kind of dives into what I was going to say and ask you a very specific question about economics, because I do not understand how we cannot talk about city economics when we talk about economics in general. And my question, I don't know the correct answer, is not macroeconomics, USA economics, the jobs report, the supply chain, all the great issues that you bring up and bring to our attention, international politics and so forth. At the end of the day, isn't American economics about what happens in the cities? Is it not the aggregate of all the great cities in America putting people to work, creating the economy, creating jobs and homes and business and healthcare and all of that? Is that not the total aggregate of America?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm just wondering
what you think about cities.
Well, cities are obviously a very, very important ingredient just because of the density of the population, the numbers of people, the amount of GDP that is related to and devoted to and arises out of cities. And it really is kind of a linear relationship to population. There's a good portion of GDP that is generated out of non-metropolitan area parts of the country. But of course, there aren't as many people located there, and as a result, there isn't as much GDP generated there. Some places have a disproportionate amount of GDP generated to their population. That would be natural resource type development, oil country, and places like that have a disproportionate GDP
farming.
Development. Pardon me? Well, farming
is maybe.
Farming isn't disproportionate. That's probably more proportionate in terms of, but it could be disproportionate. So, what you're saying is basically a simplification of just saying, look, most of the people in this country live in cities. I think if we could Google it, we'd find out that a massive supermajority of the people in this country live in metropolitan areas. When you're looking at things that are important to the people in this country and to the economy of this country, it primarily relates to metropolitan areas, but not only. And one of the problems that I think the Democratic Party has made over the past 15, 20 years has been that they have over-concentrated on urban areas to the exclusion of looking at less urban areas. And I think the genius that Donald Trump had, I hate to attribute genius to that man, but I think he had it, was his ability to tap into the feelings of the less urban parts of this country and the politics and the things that resonated with them. And I think if you looked at his base, you would find that his base is significantly less urbanized than the people we're talking about.
Yeah, I was just trying to get to your original thought, where you take a complex issue and trying to simplistic, make it a little more simplistic, and you guys are talking about schools and so forth, that all goes to cities. But the previous caller made an excellent point, because right now in the city of Milwaukee, and I would love for you to do a deep dive on the city of Milwaukee and their economics and bring that back to us someday. It would take a lot of research. But right now we have the situation in Milwaukee where the people of Mequon and the people of Brookfield, the people outside the city of Milwaukee, are pulling the strings, are controlling the purse strings of the city of Milwaukee, even though they do not contribute directly through taxes and so forth to the city's economy. But they are in total control of the city's economy.
Yeah,
to be correct. That goes back to the St. Louis example.
Yeah, we can talk about
correct example.
Yeah, we're going to a break now. We can talk sure. A little bit about that when we get back from the break. Thanks. That was what the astrophysicists call a black hole that we were in, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. I think, like, all of a sudden, all the signal went out.
That was a black hole. We
I saw matter just, like, convulsing into a large organism right in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
There was a black hole in here, and I had to get rid of it using my technical wizardry.
Yeah, well, that's good. So this is Sandy Williams. We're just emerged from a black hole. Scott Williams and I are here. Sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, Friday morning, closing in on the end of the show. We just had a call talking about a discussion of, I guess, breaking down the economy down into, like, the urban issues that we address. And
but I appreciate he was saying specifically, like, can we speak to Milwaukee specifically? And
it is a
good idea for a future show.
I think it is, but I think it's an entire show.
Right.
The complexity of metropolitan government has been addressed in some places, Seattle and Indianapolis in particular, by setting up a metro-wide government that attempted to draw the boundaries for the city as being coterminous with the boundaries of the entire metropolitan area, which in Milwaukee would end up with a city that extended up into Mequon, around even here to Waukesha, and to include the whole metropolitan area. Because the fact is that the city of Milwaukee, the boundaries that were originally drawn, were drawn to address the population that existed in 1900, which basically all existed within the boundary. But since then, most of the people living in the Milwaukee metro area don't live in the city of Milwaukee, but many of them work in the city of Milwaukee, and all of them derive value from the existence of the city of Milwaukee. So the city of Milwaukee, within its municipal boundaries, is left to address all of the issues of being the center city in a metro area, but they lack the tax capacity that would exist if they could address it from the entire metro area. But it's a complicated issue, and it was a hot political issue that was addressed in several places by setting up metro governments. The move toward metro government is fraught with hot political debate. If you can imagine the debate that would exist when the question of whether Mequon was interested in becoming a part of the Milwaukee city government.
Could be complicated,
I think. Kind of doesn't the same thing exist in the city of Chicago in all likelihood?
Same thing as in?
As we just described in Milwaukee, which is city of Chicago is surrounded by a bunch of wealthy communities. And while the city of Chicago has wealth itself, it also has a great deal of problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really surrounded by a lot of wealthy communities. It's interspersed throughout the city. You literally cross like a certain street, and then it goes from being heavily funded, either publicly or privately, to underfunded. It's insane, and it does like reflect the demographic of the community.
Yeah,
Chicago has that problem really bad, actually. You know, places like Chinatown are significantly more economically prosperous in comparison to Bridgeport, uh-huh. and they're like across the street from each other.
Right. Well, we aren't going to solve Chicago's problems.
Yeah,
and their problems, incidentally, are hip deep. Ours are currently knee deep in Milwaukee in terms of financial issues. So,
yeah.
Happily, we don't
and
face
brain
those
drain.
Well, you know, at least we have a hockey team, so.
Oh, Chicago.
There we go.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, but you know
just
what?
Shot across the bow right there.
You know what you have in exchange for the hockey team?
Yeah, too bad you don't have a quarterback.
You've got the Bears.
Yeah, now I'm going to get the whole.
I do have a question. Who does? Oh, Justin Fields.
Justin Fields. He's super athletic. The guy's actually a slot receiver. But he's playing quarterback. He tricked everyone at the Bears organization into believing he's a quarterback. So
there you go.
All right.
So, Connor, we're just going to remember this when it comes time twice this year for the Packers to play the Bears.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to do the belt celebration next time I'm on the show.
Yeah, we can have this conversation
again. This is going to be a roast, man. Like all my friends are Packers fans, uh-huh. and so whenever there's a Packers versus Bears game, I just have to sit in the corner. And
do they still call
time.
Do they still call those games?
No, they call them.
Games are usually things where there's the outcome is in question.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't say this on air, but they call it a whoopins.
Got it.
Yeah.
So
usually what happens.
There you go.
Well, we're back to what matters. We got back to the Packers Bears. We've come full circle. We started with A-Rod.
We started
and
with
ayahuasca.
We started with complexity. Well, we started out simple.
Yeah.
Shifted to complexity. Now we're back to a very, very simple matters again.
Yeah. Bears still.
Simple.
This I don't think suck is a swear. I think I can say this. It's a song. I'm quoting the name of a song.
The Bears still suck?
Yeah, it's a song.
Yeah. No, you can say suck.
Okay, I can say that. I just did.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Although the Cubs are, you know, so it is.
Don't go to baseball.
Yeah, so we got to stick with football.
Things have.
So today we've kind of addressed and tried to dice through a couple of issues, but the main theme of the thing is this question of complexity and the fact that the world has become complex and our approach to complexity has been simplicity, simple thought.
Angry simplicity,
and I think it's because we've allowed others to explain to us those complicated things which are hard for us to understand, and we have stopped the pursuit of personally the personal pursuit of information that would allow us to better understand things independent from the explanation given to us by others. So, you know, and it was kind of telling. CJ told us that he thought he'd gotten a lot of diverse information, but when it push came to shove, what he told us was that he'd been listening to Fox News for 25 years, and he listened to Joe in the morning, you know, but that was his notion of diversity in terms of developing diverse outlooks. First of all, both of those are TV media ways of obtaining information, and the TV is definitely going to always simplify and dumb down the information. So what we're going to hear are two different biased presentations of complex issues, and that doesn't probably get us all the way to understanding. The world used to be comprised of people who would sit in the morning and in front of a newspaper and read the extensive articles, the many, many inches of text that were supported by a headline that would inform them about what they were concerned about. And they might read a couple of newspapers, one in the morning and one in the evening, that gave them two different viewpoints, usually local newspapers. All of those things have sort of become things of the past.
Also journalistic integrity.
Well, the integrity has been lost with the change in the economics of journalism. Journalism lost its local ad revenue with the dot-com revolution. And with the loss of local ad revenue went the loss of local ownership. Loss of local ownership lost the focus on local issues and the streamlining of staffing that was designed to create profits with non-local ownership. Just completely changed the whole game of news media. And the news media has shifted to TV news media and then to internet news media. And so what do we have? We've got this confounding source of disinformation.
A clown car of bad media.
Yeah, well, and so what do people do when they want to figure out what's going on? What are the facts? When they do ask the question why, where do they go to get the answers?
The clown's horn that just makes the same sound every time you squeeze the black rubber thing at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, we can joke about it, but...
I'm not joking.
Oh, I know. It's
a simplistic response, right? I mean, the echo chamber that we all seek to exist in.
Well,
in
the problem
America.
Is that if even you are serious and what you want to do is look for facts that can explain to you why, you have a lot of trouble finding the sources for facts. Much more trouble today.
Well, that's why this has become an important part of teaching, right? Is helping students determine source validity and diversify their sources. What does that mean and look like? And, you know, that goes from political spectrum diversification all the way down to primary source documents that can reflect different demographic groups.
Well, and it also, I think, is reflected by the fact that we've shifted. Post-high school education has become career education rather than critical thinking by dint of the expense of that education. So I get back pretty soon to the issues that I keep raising, which is that in other countries, other than America, people don't have to worry about healthcare payments, they don't have to worry about daycare payments, and they don't have to worry about the immense expense potentially involved with post-high school education, because most of the developed countries provide all those things through the government support. And therefore, they can continue to teach critical thinking, and because it isn't so compelling that you go to post-high school education simply to find a job. You can get your vocational training in addition to or outside of that critical thinking education you might get in a liberal education. Liberal education in America is kind of going by the boards. You know, it's a difficult thing. So, you know, I hate to leave today with that negative, but I think what we need to do is we need to all start adjusting ourselves and get better at answering the question why, and get better at the process of developing our critical thinking so we as Americans can do a better job. Thanks for listening today. Earl will be back on Monday. Good to see you. Have a good weekend.
It's just a couple voices telling me I'm crazy. Your love is not a love, don't want to see it, but you make me. Your love is whenever you play a separate character. Then I stare at you and all of that fairy tale character. A beauty undefined, you're still childlike inside. A misuse of your life, so you think your mind is bright.